Theatre for Development, Historical and Institutional Perspectives. From Theatre for Development to Theatre as Development. From me, a paper from me, Tim Prenke. And welcome to all. Introduction. Rehearsing the revolution. In the Theatre of the Oppressed, Augusto Boal famously declared, "Perhaps the theatre is not revolutionary in itself, but have no doubts, it is a rehearsal of revolution." Today I want to ask, is Theatre for Development, TFD, destined to be forever in a process of rehearsal, which never finds its way to a performance? Are its facilitators endlessly rehearsing alternatives to a corrupt status quo as displacement activities, endlessly postponing the revolution? If TFD is a theatre of consciousness raising, what do we actually do after our consciousness has been raised? The tension between revolution and theatre was also articulated by Bertolt Brecht in relation to his own theatrical career. "I wanted to apply to the theatre the principle that it is important not only to interpret the world, but to change it. The changes, whether big or small, that ensued from this intention, an intention which I myself only gradually came to recognize, were only ever changes within the framework of theatre." How can theatre change the world if its changes are contained within its own frame? Perhaps the difficulty of the question explains why Marx wrote so little about art. Practitioners of TFD, at least those motivated by ambitions to address socio-political change, have wrestled with this conundrum since its inception. By applying theatre to social change, do we enable that change or merely offer ersatz change, a mirage hovering tantalizingly on the desert air? I ask these questions not to devalue the work of the past 5 decades, which has seen TFD take root among myriad NGOs, CBOs, and university departments, but only to highlight the abiding tension between domestication and liberation, containment and freedom, survival and hope. The credibility and integrity of our discipline depends upon an honest appraisal of its limitations as much as a trumpeting of its triumphs. My particular focus today is to analyze the shifting and sometimes contradictory relationship between theatre and development, and specifically to ask what the most appropriate conjunction might be for linking these two concepts. Theatre is an art form, while development is a social process. What then are its practitioners? Artists or social workers? Experts or each one of us? Theatre for whose development? In his inaugural address of January 20th, 1949, President Harry Truman set the paradigm from which the age of development emerged. "We must embark on a bold new program for making the benefits of our scientific advances and industrial progress available for the improvement and growth of underdeveloped areas." In that moment, the world became divided into developed and underdeveloped nations, with the declared mission of the developed to bring their way of life to those less fortunate than themselves, In short, to make them like us. The military colonial expeditions of former years were now replaced by the soft power of the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, and the permanent members of the UN Security Council. The golden age of development had begun. International NGOs mushroomed, governments set up departments dedicated to the policy and practice of development. Newly independent nations, desperate for cash to sustain essential public services or to feed their self-serving kleptocracies, were de facto beggars at the portals of global financial institutions, whose largesse was contingent upon signing up to their notorious conditionalities, the mechanisms through which the other would be made to behave according to the dictates of Western democracies. In this scenario, the role of TFD was almost entirely instrumental. It was a means to achieving goals set by the funding agencies, which in themselves have nothing to do with artistic processes. The answer to the question of whether TFD was effective in a given context had nothing to do with the affective experience of participants. Only whether extra theatrical goals had been met, measured by quantitative metrics. Had more pit latrines been dug? Had instances of teenage pregnancy declined, etc. The appeal of theatre lay in its usefulness in communicating to non-literate audiences who could not be reached by pamphlets and instruction manuals. However, since there was little interest from the sponsoring bodies in the medium itself, scant attention was paid to performance forms beyond crude role plays, typically revolving around dialogues between the clever development expert from the city and the stupid rural peasant who must be brought to see the error of their primitive ways. David Kerr, in writing of his experience in Malawi, makes the colonial connection explicit. In colonial health plays, for example, a wise colonial doctor struggled to convince a foolish, superstitious African, usually influenced by an evil witch doctor. The formula has remained surprisingly common in post-colonial plays created by African theatre companies and is particularly popular in plays about HIV and AIDS. Mr. Wise, the colonial health expert, has evolved into a Western-trained doctor or health worker, while Mr. Foolish is still a superstitious recalcitrant, often influenced by an identikit, evil, or mercenary witch doctor. Far from indigenous knowledge having anything to teach the developers from the north, that knowledge was perceived as a barrier to development, which needed to be destroyed as a precursor to successful outcomes. Local cultures and ancient customs stood in the path of the imposition of the global monoculture, like a ragged, grimy child trying to slow down the progress of a bulldozer. Since the 1980s, the dominance of neocolonial capitalism has been buttressed by the global spread of neoliberalism, with its reduction of all human activity and aspiration into the sphere of economics, which measures the cost of everything and the value of nothing. The consequences of this dominance for development were pointed out at the time by Panina Mlama. Attention is increasingly drawn, she wrote, to the fact that development strategies have overemphasized economic growth at the expense of the social and cultural factors which are just as crucial to the well-being of the people. The preeminence of economics as a guide to development has not occurred by accident, but by design. On September the 11th, 1973, the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende was violently overthrown by the Chilean military, backed by the United States. The ensuing months saw the destruction of democratic institutions at every level. Trade unions, cultural organizations, the media, accompanied by the shrinking of the state in every sector, except for the armed forces and the police. The role of the state was no longer to support and protect its people, but to support and protect itself at the expense of the people. Public infrastructure was destroyed to be replaced by either the private provision of education, healthcare, and transport, or no provision at all. The coup amounted to the creation of a ground zero on which privatization would flourish, unhindered by regulation, unlimited in its scope. This was the realization of the plan concocted by Milton Friedman and his Chicago boys, who arrived in Chile to take up advisory roles with Pinochet's regime. Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and an array of Western governments, taking their lead from the prescriptions of the IMF, followed the Chilean model, albeit less crudely. If this was a cold climate in which to practice any form of TFD intended to foster human rights and self-determination, worse was to follow after the 2nd, September the 11th, 2001, when George Bush opted not to pursue the perpetrators of the attacks on the USA as criminals, but rather to declare his infamous war on terror. Perhaps the only time war has been declared on an abstract noun. The present age of what Naomi Klein has termed disaster capitalism was inaugurated, allowing governments to declare emergencies that bypass democratic controls, paving the way for multinational corporations to reshape the contours of entire countries and collect vast fortunes in the process. For instance, of the Defense Authorization Act 2006, Klein wrote, it gave the president the power to declare martial law and employ the armed forces, including the National Guard, overriding the wishes of state governors in the event of a public emergency in order to restore public order and suppress the disorder. That emergency could be a hurricane, a mass protest, or a public health emergency. As development funds have been increasingly redirected towards disaster relief, in a world where disaster is frequently a deliberate weapon of political choice, so TFD finds itself working in contexts of survival, supporting the victims of disasters, both natural and man-made, in refugee and internment camps, providing a displacement activity for the homeless, desperate, and destitute. In the light of what the Western notion of development has given to the African continent, it is not surprising that Akil Mbembe says that the function of art in Africa is precisely to free us from the shackles of development, both as an ideology and as a practice. Participation without domestication. One of the central tensions, or perhaps fault lines, running through TFD has been that between participation and domestication. It is self-evidently in the interests of development organizations to strive for maximum participation, or that deceptively cozy word, inclusion, in any given project, since that will increase the likelihood of a successful outcome. However, if the agenda is preset from outside the community, no amount of participation can enable community ownership of decisions or implementations. Mlama has long since highlighted grassroots experience as the foundation of a TFD methodology to avoid domestication. She wrote, first is the recognition of the people's way of life as the starting point in development action. Popular theatre begins with the grassroots community and with what its members think are the major concerns of their lives. As an illustration of the importance of people's participation in mobilising for social change, I want to recall the famous instance of Ngugi wa Thiong'o's theatrical practice in relation to the Kenyan state. Prior to his much-chronicled work with Ngugi wa Thiong'o at the Kamiri-Thru Cultural Centre at Limuru, Ngugi, with Mikere Mugo, wrote The Trial of Dedan Kimathi, which was performed in English at the University Theatre in Nairobi before being taken to Festac in Lagos as an official Kenyan entry. Looked at solely from the aspect of content, it could be suggested that the play is every bit as subversive towards the government as anything created subsequently at Kamiri-Thru. Kimathi's final address to the people before sentence is passed upon him reads as follows. Organize in your homes, organize in the mountains. Know that your only kindred blood is he who is in the struggle. Denounce those who weaken our struggle by creating ethnic divisions. Uproot from you those who are selling out to imperialism. Kenyan masses shall be free. As an attack upon the neo-colonial administration of Kenya, this is hardly disguised. Nevertheless, the response of the state was to embrace the cultural product, secure in the knowledge that its English language appeal was to a middle-class sector of the populace who would not be taken to the streets to demand revolutionary action. By contrast, the script which the Ngugis created from the community at Limuru, Ungahahika Ndeyenda, I will marry when I want, earned them detention and exile, and led to the razing of the cultural centre to the ground. It was the articulation of grassroots experience in the mouths of the people themselves that proved so frightening to the establishment. The trumpet of the masses has been blown. We are tired of being robbed. We are tired of exploitation. We are tired of land grabbing. We are tired of slavery. We are tired of charity and abuses. This famous example from Kamiri-Thru illustrates Zeke Madar's hypothesis around what he termed optimal intervention, where the material of the drama derives from the community experience and is shaped by what he calls the catalyst, today usually termed a facilitator. Theatre for Development practitioners, he wrote, in their dramatisation work with local communities, should create a balanced situation that will result in optimal intervention. Optimal here refers to the most favourable or desirable condition. Optimal intervention would therefore mean the best compromise between the opposing tendencies of participation and intervention. As in the case with optimal heterophily, there cannot be a standard of what optimal intervention is. All that can be said is that it is attained at that point when intervention is just sufficient to serve the three functions, naming, reflection, action, and does not go to the extent of imposing the catalyst's own views and values on the process of dramatization. This finding places a great responsibility on the catalyst. It confirms an assertion that catalysts must have a higher level of social consciousness than the villagers. Without this higher level of social consciousness and of critical awareness, they cannot play their interventionist role effectively, and the villagers will remain unconscientized through the theatre. Madar's assertion begs the question of how this higher level of social consciousness is achieved. Some might answer that it is the role of the university to train facilitators to just such a level, and that Madar's call has been responded to throughout the last 30 years by the plethora of courses which have sprung up, offering degrees in applied, community, social theatre. Does this in turn create a cadre of experts in search of suitable places to practice? Are university-trained facilitators imbued with a burning desire of injustice and a desire to change the world? How many of those who might loosely be termed the oppressed find their way onto such courses in order to return to their native communities as TFT facilitators? A cursory glance around the world is not encouraging, perhaps because the funding that enables them to operate in the field at all also prevents them from exercising social consciousness and critical awareness. Whether conducted in institutional or informal contexts, I believe that the cornerstones of such training are to be located in the theories of Paulo Freire and Bertolt Brecht, specifically around the concepts of codification and verfremdung. Freire makes explicit how the facilitator is to employ codes in the organization of a praxis. The first requirement is that these codifications must necessarily represent situations familiar to the individuals whose thematics are being examined, so that they can easily recognize the situations. It is inadmissible to present pictures of reality unfamiliar to the participants. The latter procedure cannot come before the more basic one dictated by the participant's state of submersion, that is, the process in which individuals analyzing their own reality become aware of their earlier distorted perceptions and thereby arrive at a new perception of that reality. Earlier, Brecht reflected upon a similar process in the context of theatre, a process which he termed Verfremdung. For them to be able to doubt all these things that they take for granted, they would need to develop that strange gaze with which the great Galileo observed the swinging chandelier. He was astonished by these oscillations, as if he had not expected them to be like that, and so could not understand them, which led him to establish the laws that govern them. This gaze, as problematic as it is productive, is what the theatre must provoke with its representations of the way people live together. It must make its audience feel astonishment. And this can be achieved by techniques that make the familiar seem strange. Both Verfremdung and codification are counter-hegemonic strategies designed to strip externally imposed ideological frameworks from the lived experience of those who are oppressed by such frameworks. In the era of fake news and anti-social media, it is a critical function of facilitation to offer TFT participants the tools with which to make optimal interventions into their realities. As reflective, self-conscious beings, we are constantly attempting to understand and interpret our experiences. To do so in a manner that leaves us with the agency to act upon such understandings, it is important to decode the mediations through which they are being manipulated, these days often by computer-generated algorithms. Only when we own our experience and take control of its meaning can we begin to intervene in the wider world. In TFD, this intervention is fundamentally playful in all three senses of the word. Firstly, participants enter into a process where they play together, creating and improvising back to a lost childhood, or perhaps a childhood never experienced. Secondly, the process typically leads to the making of plays, either within the closed space of a drama workshop or as a public theatrical event with a target audience. Thirdly, there is play in the process, in the sense of movement, flexibility, changes of position, as when we speak of materials having play in them. The playful drama requires fluidity of a kind that opens up an opportunity for empathy, for exploring the self in the other and the other in the self. This happens when we take on a character who appears initially antithetical to us or beyond our experience, and when the gap is opened between the actor and the character, even when we are dramatizing our own story. The retelling, structured into the drama, creates a distance between the actor and the character, into which critical reflection on the relationship between ourselves and the wider world can occur. As Bauhaus' use of the term joker suggests, there is an intrinsic, deep connection between facilitation and fooling. "We propose a joker," he wrote, "who is a contemporary and neighbor of the spectator. This, it is necessary to restrict his explanations. It is necessary to move him away from the other characters, to bring him close to the spectators. Within this system, the explanations given periodically are designed to make the performance develop on two different and complementary levels. That of the fable, which can use all the conventional imaginative resources of the theatre, and that of the lecture, in which the joker becomes an exegete." In speaking of the two levels, Bauhaus might equally be referring to a character such as Azdak in Brecht's The Caucasian Chalk Circle, who operates as a protagonist within the fable and as a commentator upon it, with both functions fusing when he takes on the role of the judge. In turn, Brecht, as he acknowledged in his notes to the play, is reaching back to the tradition of Shakespeare, who developed the persona of the semi-detached fool, exploiting the capacities of Robert Armin. That persona is most fully exemplified in the characters of Feste and Lear's fool. Folly, besides speaking truth to power, is the time-honored device for exploding contradiction and dislodging the fixed positions that stem from ideological certainty. The moral philosopher John Paul Leverac has drawn attention to the importance of playfulness, of the importance of the playfulness of art for ensuring the quality of our lives and the hope of our survival. The greatest artists of all time had a knack for playfulness, for seeing life inside things. Too much seriousness creates art with a message, but rarely creates great art. There is no scientific evidence that seriousness leads to greater growth and maturity or insight into the human condition than playfulness. It is this spirit of playfulness which informed Michael Etherton's TFD practice with Save the Children, framed within the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, in particular Article 13. "The child shall have the right to freedom of expression. This freedom shall include the right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers, either orally, in writing, or in print, in the form of art, or through any other media of the child's choice." The rights agenda, developed through UN agencies, stands in marked contradiction to the neoliberal policies to which the signatories of the CRC also subscribe. Indeed, the implementation of neoliberal economics guarantees that these rights are not fulfilled for the overwhelming majority of their populations. Nevertheless, within NGO discourses, the evocation of rights in relation to TFD with young people has opened the door to practices of possibility and hope, as Etherton articulates. "What constantly amazes us adults is the quality of the drama the young people create in the process of defining the infringement of their rights. In country after country, in culture after culture, children and young people have a beautiful sense of dramatic improvisation. Young people's art in all kinds of creative media, coupled with their struggle for their rights in an unfair world, stands a good chance of changing the future in ways we adults cannot now imagine." Conclusion. Today, as we contemplate the rich history of TFD and wonder what tomorrow may bring, I believe it is high time to, in Mbugi's phrase, decolonize the mind of all those engaged in TFT. Practitioners, funders, universities, NGOs alike. Such a decolonization requires a reversal, a verfremdung of the familiar dominant trope of development. For instance, the funds that emanate from the institutions of the so-called developed world are in fact nothing other than reparations or war damages for the centuries of exploitation and pillage that the colonized have suffered. As George Monbiot points out, this accumulation of debt has been accompanied by a massive transfer of natural resources from the poor world to the rich world. If these resources were valued according to their utility, nations of the poor world would surely be the creditors, and the nations of the rich world, the debtors. As the Native American leader, Guaicapuro Cuauhtemoc, has pointed out, between 1503 and 1660, 185,000 kilograms of gold and 16 million kilograms of silver were shipped from Latin America to Europe. Cuauhtemoc argues that his people should see this transfer not as a war crime, but as the first of several friendly loans granted by America for Europe's development. Were the indigenous people of Latin America to charge compound interest on this loan at the modest rate of 10%, Europe would owe them a volume of gold and silver which exceeded the weight of the planet. Not only is the industrial model of progress on which the developed world's prosperity is based rapidly making the planet uninhabitable, it was also funded by the theft of resources from those parts of the world which have contributed least to the process of ruination. Without resorting to some pre-colonial fantasy of a golden age, the time to learn from indigenous knowledge is overdue. Incas built earthquake-proof homes, now studied by Japanese architects. Australian Aboriginal peoples understood the significance of fire breaks in the bush. The message for African TFD is spelt out by Achille Mbembe. Without a new ethics of recognition, solidarity, and mutuality, the way most Western cultural funding, or for that matter, development funding agencies operate, will become ever more destructive of the continent's capacity to culturally and artistically account for itself in the world. Since Mbembe spoke these words, the urgency of the climate emergency has made them yet more relevant for the future development of Africa and for the ultimate survival of human life on this planet. Amy Klein wrote, "There is little doubt that another crisis will see us in the streets and squares once again, taking us all by surprise." This written before the coronavirus, of course. The real question is what progressive forces will make of that moment, the power and confidence with which it will be seized. Because these moments when the impossible seems suddenly possible are excruciatingly rare and precious. That means more must be made of them. Next time one arises, it must be harnessed not only to denounce the world as it is, and build fleeting pockets of liberated space. It must be the catalyst to actually build the world that will keep us all safe. The stakes are simply too high and time too short to settle for anything else. Theatre for Development in Africa must be recruited as one of these progressive forces because it has the methodologies through which the lived experiences of communities can be harnessed in the search for environmentally friendly, sustainable ways of being. I finish where I began, with Brecht, taught only by reality. Can reality be changed?